From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
This is Josh Barrow, and you're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. I'm joined, as always, by Ken White for our weekly exploration of Donald Trump's sprawling legal issues. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com, and he hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Josh.
So we will get to Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort and what is next for them and their associates later in the show. But this week, we want to start with some civil litigation, an appetizer to the main course of those criminal proceedings. Specifically, let's talk about Stormy Daniels' libel suit against the president. Daniels, the porn star who says that she had an affair with Donald Trump about a decade ago, has alleged that a man threatened her in a parking lot years ago, at the same time that people close to Trump were pressuring her not to go public about that alleged affair. Earlier this year, Trump tweeted about that allegation, saying that it was, quote, a total con job. So she sued him in state court in New York for libeling her by claiming that she was lying about the threat. That litigation has now been removed from state court to federal court. And Ken, what lucky federal judge is going to be handling that litigation?
It's our friend Judge Otero, the one who here in the Central District of California has handled two Stormy Daniels versus Trump cases. And here he is now with his third ever Trump-related case, because he is the Trump whisperer, the Stormy Daniels whisperer.
So we've discussed on the show previously, he clearly strangled a koala bear in a previous life or something.
He's basically a legal Job. I mean, I don't know what he did.
But he may not have this lawsuit for long. President Trump has filed what's called an anti-slap motion in this suit. Can you explain what that means?
Absolutely. So SLAP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And an anti-slap motion is a motion under a state statute that gives defendants in a free speech-related case a special early procedural vehicle to get the case dismissed. It basically allows you to tell the judge, look, judge, this case attacks my free speech rights. Here's the evidence why. And if you make that showing, then the plaintiff who's bringing the case has to come forward with evidence showing they can still win.
And so in this instance where Donald Trump says he's protected by the statute that's supposed to block these strategic lawsuits against public participation, he's saying, I was expressing an opinion. Opinions are absolutely protected by the First Amendment. You can't sue me for libel because you don't like the opinion that I expressed on Twitter. And so I guess what's the argument here? I can read out precisely what Donald Trump tweeted, and then let's talk about why this might be an opinion in the eye of the court. So this tweet was reacting to a composite sketch that Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, had commissioned based on her description of the man she says threatened her in this parking lot. A number of people on the internet were claiming that the sketch looked awfully similar to Stormy Daniels' ex-boyfriend or ex-husband. And so anyway, the president is also commenting on this sketch and goes, a sketch years later about a non-existent man, a total con job playing the fake news media for fools, but they know it. So, Ken, doesn't this sound like a factual claim? He's saying that the story that Stormy Daniels told about being threatened by this man in a parking lot was false. Why would that be an opinion rather than a factual claim?
It's because of the way it's presented, Josh. So the way he presents it is that he puts in his tweet a link to somebody else's tweet showing the two pictures, her sketch artist sketch of the person she said threatened her, and then a picture of her with her ex. And they do look rather stunningly similar, the sketch and her ex. And Donald Trump's tweet is a reaction to that and a comment on it. So this is rather like me putting out a tweet with a link to a New York Times story and saying Donald Trump clearly colluded with the Russians. That would be my opinion based on the disclosed facts in the article. Similarly, Trump here is offering his opinion about this based on what's in the tweet that he's commenting on. That's a fairly classic example of an opinion based on disclosed facts. And that's generally absolutely protected by the First Amendment.
But so what if Donald Trump had knowledge about what happened with Stormy Daniels? Let's say, for example, that he knew that someone had threatened her in the parking lot. Would it still be an opinion? Because they're basically saying he's expressing his opinion that her claim is not believable about this having happened.
Only if he suggested in the tweet that it was based on his knowledge. But he doesn't. He's commenting on this other tweet. So you don't get to the analysis of whether or not the statement is true or false until you resolve whether it's a statement of fact. And once again, we're dealing in the universe of Twitter and Trump tweets, both of which are generally understood to be rhetorical hyperbole and, you know, trash talking, and less likely to be interpreted by a court as a provable statement of fact. So I think that he likely has the better argument here.
Right. So it sounds like you think it's pretty clear that he's going to prevail on this claim. Was it stupid for Stormy Daniels and Michael Avenatti to have brought this litigation in the first place?
Well, it might be legally stupid, but I don't know that it is public relations stupid. So for some time, we've been talking about how Michael Avenatti and maybe to a lesser extent Stormy Daniels have a strategy that is not purely legal, but that's a public relations strategy of putting intense pressure on Trump and on the people in his orbit. So I do think that it's a lawsuit that was very likely to draw an anti-slap motion and very likely to draw one that would win, and that it's entirely possible she'll wind up ordered to pay Donald Trump's legal fees for this lawsuit. That said, continuing to put pressure on him and continuing to keep these things in the news might serve the non-legal things that Michael Avenatti is trying to accomplish.
Let's talk about some of the other claims that Donald Trump's attorney Charles Harder makes in this filing, because we've talked on the show before about argument in the alternative, and when Rudy Giuliani goes out and says, you know, the president didn't collude, and even if he did, collusion isn't a crime, that's not a very good public relations strategy, but it can be something that makes sense as a litigation strategy in court. And so basically, Harder puts out several theories of why the president is not liable, and the first is this, you know, that he has rights under this anti-slap statute, but then another claim that he makes is that Daniels cannot show, even if she had been libeled, that she was damaged at all by the libel. And so what's the argument there?
Well, there are really two arguments. One argument, I think, is fairly shrewd, and it's that this is all part of hers and Michael Avenatti's PR strategy, and that the president calling attention to this tweet and challenging her story, far from harming her, is simply playing into her hands and part of the general strategy they have of using everything he does to promote themselves and get on TV a lot, and that she can't prove damages. The other argument is in my mind, kind of gross. It's basically the idea that an adult actress cannot be defamed. And Trump and his lawyer, Harder, do this by listing the names of some of her films, which are naturally pretty extreme. And
Dripping Wet Sex 4, Pussy Sweat, Porking with Pride 2, Toxic Cum Load 6. These are film titles that are listed in the filing in court.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, the implication is clear that, you know, this is a woman who can't be defamed. This is a, you know, really the tone of the motion is that she's a worthless person. But, I mean, the truth is that you can be defamed even if you do things that are carry a lot of social disapproval. And this was a statement that she was lying, which, if it were a statement of fact, then I think she could be defamed about her truthfulness, even if she's in an adult actress profession. So I don't think it's a very strong argument. It seems to be more of a Trump-pleasing argument, a lashing out, as opposed to a good substantive argument.
But the need to show damages is interesting, and I thought that it was interesting the analysis here about what's called defamation per se, which is that basically there are certain false claims that people can make about you where you can go to court and the court just presumes that it was damaging to you. But then there are other kinds of false claims where you have to show not only that the claim was a false statement of fact and meet various other bars, you also have to show that you were harmed, and they have arguments for why it falls into that latter box here with Stormy Daniels.
Of course. And Josh, if you've ever had an argument about defamation on the internet, internet, which hopefully you're smart enough not to, you'll see people raising this idea of defamation per se and suggesting that it means that if this is defamation per se, I don't even have to prove that it's false. And that's not true anymore. It hasn't been for about 50 years. Now you're exactly right. Defamation per se is a class of defamation, a type of accusation where you don't have to prove special damages. They will presume that there's at least some damages if you can show that this factual statement about you is false. And often, this category reflects social judgments that are changing. So there used to be very common categories like the accusation you were convicted of a crime, the accusation that you were bad at your business. And now the categories are shifting. In a number of states, it used to be defamation per se to accuse somebody of being gay. That's no longer the case because of shifting social feelings about different categories of things.
And so in this instance, Daniels tries to claim that the president was accusing her of a crime, which is to say that filing a false police report is a crime. And Harder makes what I think you think are fairly persuasive arguments that that doesn't apply here because they don't literally accuse her of a crime.
That's kind of a stretch, really, because you know, he doesn't go into exactly what she said in the police report. And I don't think it's a persuasive argument.
Let's talk about the other two pieces of Stormy Daniels-related litigation that have been before Judge Otero. Now, one of them I think we can dispense with pretty quickly. This is her lawsuit against Keith Davidson, her former lawyer. She's suing him for being a bad lawyer. This one, Judge Otero was able to kick away to a California state court.
Right. Basically, there was not federal jurisdiction because all the defendants were not from different places than all the plaintiffs. And so for federal jurisdictional reasons, he kicked it back to California.
And then there's Stormy Daniels' lawsuit against Michael Cohen, the granddaddy of all these lawsuits, where she's suing him to get out of the hush agreement. That suit has been held up with a series of stays pending the criminal investigation into Cohen in New York. So where does it stand now that Cohen has pleaded guilty in New York?
They just filed a very typical federal civil filing. It's a joint brief where everyone gives their respective ideas about how the rest of the case is going to go. And it reflects the dramatically different views of President Trump's team and Stormy Daniels' team. So one side, by Michael Avenatti on behalf of Stormy Daniels, is arguing that, well, Judge, you can lift the stay now because Michael Cohen has pled guilty. Therefore, he doesn't have any Fifth Amendment rights anymore, and we can proceed with this case. Cohen and Trump are pointing out correctly that that's completely wrong. Even when you plead guilty, you do not waive your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. You don't now have to start answering any question put to you. For one thing, your answers could incriminate you in connection with sentencing and make your sentence worse. They could incriminate you in connection with other crimes. So I think Judge Otero is likely to reject that argument that Michael Cohen has, by pleading guilty, waived all his Fifth Amendment rights and that those Fifth Amendment rights shouldn't impact this case at all. Now that Cohen's pled guilty, Judge Otero might reevaluate the stay he's put in place. He might reweigh the factors and decide that this can go forward. If it does go forward, you have to remember where we are procedurally. It's kind of a nightmare. So the whole case, so many months ago that started, is about whether or not this hush money agreement, that is one of the subjects of Cohen's guilty plea, is enforceable. This was an agreement between an entity that Cohen set up and Stormy Daniels that she promised that she would not reveal things about her alleged relationship with President Trump in exchange for money. And this case is about whether or not that agreement is enforceable and whether or not the arbitration clause in it is enforceable, whether or not the president and Cohen can force her into private arbitration. If the case starts up again, if Judge Otero decides, well, I'm going to lift the stay now that Mr. Cohen's pled guilty, then we'll be back where we were months ago with Judge Otero looking at a motion to compel arbitration and deciding a few very crucial things. First, do I let Stormy Daniels take some limited discovery in order to attack this agreement and argue that it shouldn't be arbitrated? Do I even let her take the deposition of the President of the United States? And do I allow a mini trial on the subject of whether the agreement is enforceable and therefore whether it should go to arbitration? So that's where the case is right now.
Why does Michael Cohen have a continued interest in defending this lawsuit should the stay be lifted? I can understand what the president's ongoing interest is. He would like, to the extent that he can, either to stop Stormy Daniels from talking even more, or perhaps to obtain damages from her. But Michael Cohen, you know, is now on the outs with the president. Why should he care whether Stormy Daniels performs on this agreement or not?
Well, even though his interests are now opposed to those of the president, they're not necessarily consistent with Stormy Daniels' interest. He may want to save up the answers he has and to give them to special counsel Robert Mueller, not to Michael Avenatti. He wants credit for it. Avenatti's goals on behalf of Stormy Daniels are more to watch the world burn, to get out the information in public about what Cohen and Trump did. So they don't have exactly consistent interests, even though I think they're both very opposed to Trump.
Well, let's take a short break. And right afterward, Ken White and I will talk about what's next in criminal court for Michael Cohen. We are back. Michael Cohen has pleaded guilty to 8 felonies, and he's supposed to be sentenced sometime in the next few months. And people have been wondering a few things. One is, even though there's no formal cooperation agreement between Michael Cohen and the federal government, people have been wondering whether Cohen might seek to cooperate with investigators in exchange for a reduced sentence. Certainly his lawyer, Lanny Davis, has been all over television pushing that idea and sticking his foot in his mouth, as we'll discuss in a little bit. And relatedly, people are wondering who else might be investigated or indicted based on the evidence that was revealed in the Cohen plea. Those investigations could be by the special counsel, by the Southern District of New York, by Congress, by the Manhattan District Attorney, or by the New York Attorney General. So let's start where one always wants to start, which is RICO. My MSNBC colleague Rachel Maddow highlighted a carve-out in Cohen's plea agreement, which says while the government agrees not to charge him for a variety of crimes as part of the agreement, they reserve the option to charge him under the RICO racketeering statute. Is this RICO, Ken?
It's not RICO, and the clause that Ms. Maddow looked at and talked about doesn't mean what she says it means. So, we've all done this. I flipped out at Rachel Maddow on Twitter. I mean, we're human. We're all human. Basically, she took a piece of the Cohen plea agreement. And she highlighted it and said, look, this says that even though we're not going to prosecute you anymore for these things, these facts could still be used as predicate facts in a RICO prosecution. But the truth is that's absolutely stock standard language in almost all the plea agreements you get out of that office. And I can tell you, when I was a prosecutor drafting plea agreements, you always just go back and you use the boilerplate and you tweak it, but you leave all sorts of boilerplate stuff in there. That's one thing that's in there. Another thing that you would see in there is language saying that if Michael Cohen is an illegal alien, he could get deported. Now, we know that he's not an illegal alien. That language is in there because it's boilerplate. So it's a highlight of the danger of these types of things, where we're going over all these legal documents like they're the Zapruder film or something. And if you try to take significance from things without knowing why they're there, you might be led down a completely wrong path.
What about the immunity deals? People have been very focused on this. David Pecker, the CEO of American Media, which is the company that owns the National Enquirer, and Alan Weisselberg, who is the CFO of the Trump Organization. Both of these figures, there have been media reports about them receiving some sort of immunity as part of the investigation into Cohen. Does that signal a larger investigation? In particular, we had Duncan Levin on Left, Right, and Center on Friday, and his view was basically Alan Weisselberg is too big a fish to be someone who received immunity as part of the process to prosecute Cohen, and that means that they're likely looking at somebody bigger.
Josh, it's entirely possible, but I'd know more and I'd feel more comfortable giving you my educated guess on it if we knew for sure what type of immunity they got. So there are varying degrees. Some of it is very routine and easy, like so-called use immunity, sometimes called a queen for a day arrangement, where basically your particular set of testimony on a particular day, they agree they won't use it against you. That's routine. Far less routine are things like transactional immunity, where they decide that, okay, we've promised you that we're never going to prosecute you for anything related to this whole incident if you testify. That's much more unusual and reflects that they're much further along and you're much more important. So we don't know what type of immunity these two men got, but I'll agree they are high up. And in general, it wouldn't be normal strategy to punch down. You wouldn't flip people like these downwards against Michael Cohen, who, in the scheme of things, is a smaller fish than either of them.
So what should we be watching for on the front of this federal investigation around Michael Cohen? Because we had this shocking news back in April of the raid on his home and his office, and that's basically what set off everyone's public knowledge that this criminal inquiry was ongoing. How and when will we know if the Southern District of New York is continuing to work on this investigation and who it might be investigating?
I think that if they're continuing to use these people, you could see more searches, you could see sudden arrests, you could see sudden abrupt guilty pleas, as we have before, at any time over the next few months.
And then let's talk briefly about the possibility of these state-level probes. I think it's still pretty speculative at this point, but what do you make of news about the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan District Attorney sniffing around the Trump Organization related to the Cohen plea?
Well, they're issuing subpoenas. They're certainly looking to see what they can get out of him that they might be able to use against the Trump Organization. And of course, the significance of all that is that the president can pardon federal crimes but cannot pardon state crimes. So for many months now, we've been hearing speculation that people want to put together state cases that are bulletproof, that the president can't eliminate, in effect, through the pardon power. I think we'll see more subpoenas. We may even see some search warrants. But the state does not have the same expertise, the same resources, or the same power to do these investigations the way the feds do. And I think you'll see them going more haphazardly and more slowly.
I suppose we have to talk about Lanny Davis.
I suppose.
So Lanny Davis has been lying, but we don't know when he's been lying and we don't know what he's been lying about. Davis told several outlets Michael Cohen was present for a conversation where Donald Jr. told Donald Sr. he'd be meeting with Russians to seek dirt on Hillary Clinton and that this meeting was ahead of the Trump Tower meeting and therefore that Michael Cohen can establish the president's foreknowledge of the purpose of the Trump Tower meeting. Now Davis says he has no personal knowledge of this claim and that he was wrong to confirm it to news outlets. CNN is one of the outlets that reported this, and they're still standing behind their story. They say they have more than one source, and they're still confident that it's true, even though Lanny Davis has recanted. What do you make of this in the context that Lanny Davis is supposed to be Michael Cohen's attorney?
Oh, I think it's disastrous for him and for Cohen. Lanny Davis was supposed to be the smart media guy. It devastates his credibility. It basically reduces him to the level of Rudy Giuliani going out there and flailing around in the media and becoming a widespread symbol of fun. And it even undermines Cohen's credibility and undermines his usefulness as a potential cooperator because as my friend Mitch Eppner, another former AUSA who wrote about this, says, is that Lanny Davis's lies can, to some extent, be attributed to Cohen if he ever becomes a witness, and he can be cross-examined about it and his knowledge about it and, you know, how the press was misled about this and how lies were told on his behalf.
It sort of looks like Davis got caught between two objectives. One is to really create this appearance that Cohen has valuable information that investigators should want and should be willing to give him a reduced sentence in exchange. And the other is to not suggest that Cohen lied, for example, before Congress when he made previous claims about this meeting. That is, Cohen seems to have told the Senate Intelligence Committee that he personally had no foreknowledge of the Trump Tower meeting. So it would be hard to square that with the idea that he was around when the president gained his foreknowledge of that meeting.
That's right. And it's another example, I think, of how we've been seeing in this whole thing since we started this podcast, the conflict between your legal interests and your public relations interests. So Cohen had not just in order to get a good deal with Mueller, but just as part of his general public relations strategy, every reason to push the idea he had all this great inside information about the president. But doing that doesn't necessarily help him in court. And here, that public relations strategy has shot him in the foot in court.
Is this campaign by Cohen trying to get the reduced sentence and having his lawyer out there with these dubious claims about what knowledge that he had about Donald Trump's behavior, is this a reason to worry about something Alan Dershowitz keeps telling us we should worry about, which is that when these criminal defendants come under pressure, they don't just sing, they compose? It seems like Michael Cohen, it certainly doesn't seem beneath him to make up a lie about the president's criminal liability in an effort to get himself off.
Absolutely. And you always wonder about cooperators, and the system gives cooperators a gigantic incentive to do exactly that, to tell prosecutors what they want to hear, to make their stories what makes them the most useful, to tell stories that make the prosecutor want to put them on the stand at a trial or maybe a congressional hearing. And that's the type of pressure that happens in all types of cases, not just big, high publicity cases involving the president's lawyer. So it does reveal a basic structural flaw about the way we use cooperators and how I think, unfortunately, we are not skeptical enough about what they have to say.
Although I wonder if there's reason to think that federal investigators have been appropriately skeptical of Michael Cohen as a cooperator, which is to say there's no cooperation agreement. There's no indication that that federal investigators are relying on Michael Cohen's testimony about the president. And Robert Mueller chose not even to prosecute this case. He kicked it over to the Southern District of New York and deemed it sufficiently unrelated to his core mission of investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election and matters arising from that. He didn't seem to want Michael Cohen on his plate.
I think you're exactly right, Josh. And I think, you know, when we talked about this before, I speculated that that was the reason there's no cooperation agreement, because Cohen comes with a lot of baggage. He comes with a lot of bad judgment. I think that saying that has been proven in the last week with the Lanny Davis catastrophe. And Mueller is probably being smart and saying, I don't need to tie myself to this guy unless and until it's absolutely necessary.
Let's talk a little bit about Paul Manafort. He faces an additional criminal trial to start next month in the District of Columbia. This is the trial over charges he failed to register as a foreign agent when he was lobbying for this Ukrainian political party. That trial has been delayed by a week, but it should still start on September 24. And there were news reports that Manafort tried to reach a plea deal in this case, but negotiations around that broke down. Now, when this happened, people were sort of really jumping on this and saying, oh, even Manafort might end up cooperating. I feel like there's a distinction that needs to be drawn between discussing a plea deal and discussing a cooperation deal.
Right, exactly. You can plead to crimes without cooperating. And the crimes with which Manafort is charged, both in Virginia and in Washington, D.C., he could plead to them without implicating the president in anything. He could plead to them without cooperating or helping Robert Mueller flip against anyone else. So it's entirely possible that he was just negotiating for some sort of resolution, wrapping both cases together and coming up with some sort of sentencing range. He didn't necessarily have to be dangling the idea that he might cooperate against the president or anyone else. And indeed, with the president signaling so strongly that he appreciates Manafort's omerta, his refusal to tell stories about Trump, and signaling strongly, I think, that there may be a pardon in it for him at some point, you know, it might not be a good idea for Manafort to cooperate.
Speaking of negotiations inside the White House about whether to pardon Paul Manafort, Don McGahn, the White House counsel, and one of the people who you see these news reports maybe planted by people close to Don McGahn about how Don McGahn runs around with his hair on fire trying to stop the president from doing extremely legally stupid things. Don McGahn is going to leave the White House this fall. That was just announced this Wednesday. What do you make of the significance of that? The expectation is that Emmett Flood, this other prominent lawyer inside the White House, is likely to succeed him as White House counsel.
Well, I'm not going to speculate about what drives the man. Maybe he's done his time in purgatory. It cannot be pleasant to, as you said, be in the position of trying to get this administration not to violate the law and to keep people out of trouble. I don't know that we can necessarily take too much from the idea that he's decided to leave. That could be in part because of the tension arising from him going and answering questions.
This is Don McGahn. He sat for an immense number of hours of interviews with the special prosecutor with the authorization of the White House, but the news report suggested the White House didn't realize how extensively he'd been talking with the special prosecutor's investigators. The other thing I'd note, though, about McGahn is that McGahn has had a tremendously successful tenure in terms of shepherding judicial nominations through the White House into Congress and getting a tremendous number of federal judges, especially appellate judges, confirmed to the courts. And then presumably he will have also presided over two successful nominations to the Supreme Court. So even if this weren't a scandal-ridden administration and an extremely stressful place to be the White House counsel, you could have a credible argument that you put in a very productive 2 years, and that's why you're leaving. So while Don McGahn, you know, we focus on his travails related to the president's odd behavior, the more traditional aspect of the job, he seems to be a conventional success in.
Absolutely. He may, after this, he will be a welcome speaker on the Federalist Circuit, but I'm sure it will feel good to be out of the the daily press focus and out of the frying pan.
Well, there is so much more to talk about, but I think that is a good place to leave it this week. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me again.
Thank you, Josh.
We will have another Left, Right, and Center episode for you on Friday. This week we have Rich Lowry on the right and Anna Marie Cox on the left. There's already a lot to talk about this week. We will be remembering John McCain and his legacy. We'll be talking about the president's supposed announcement of a U.S.-Mexico free trade deal. I don't think it can quite work that way, and we'll see what goes on this week with efforts to bring Canada into those negotiations. And there were primaries in Florida and Arizona with some pretty surprising results, going to set up a pretty crazy governor's race in Florida. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This program is produced by Sarah Fay. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be back on Friday with Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.